The Curbsiders Teach podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions.
Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the speakers and should not be interpreted to reflect the official policy or position of any entity. You should always do your homework and give us any feedback.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders Teach, the podcast for health professions education. I'm Dr. Molly Hoyblein, joined by my co-host, Dr. Ira Krishnovskaya. On today's episode, we'll discuss remediating clinical reasoning skills with Dr. Sarah Vick. Before we get started with that, Ira, will you remind the audience what we do on this podcast?
You got it, Molly. We are the health professions podcast for all things education. We use expert interviews to bring you teaching pearls and practice-changing knowledge to inspire the next generation of clinician educators. We have a fantastic conversation with our guest, Dr. Sarah Vick, tonight. We cover the steps of the pyramid along clinical reasoning from hypothesis generation all the way to management plans and really give you practical tips on how to address any kind of deficits that come in those domains.
Dr. Sarah Vick is originally from Evansville, Indiana, and completed her medical degree at the Indiana University School of Medicine. She did her internal medicine residency and chief year at the University of Kentucky, and she has stayed as faculty at UK as an academic hospitalist, where she is currently one of the associate program directors.
And we are super excited to bring you this season of Curbsiders Teach with the support of and in partnership with the Alliance for Academic Internal Medicine. And a reminder that most episodes are available for CME credit through VCU Health CE for all health professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. And thank you to all our Patreon members. If you love the Curbsiders family content, but you haven't joined yet, please consider supporting us and continuing to create this amazing resource.
So without further ado,
let's get to it.
Dr. Vick, thank you so much for joining us today on the show. We're really happy to get to sit down and talk with you. Are you okay if we call you Sarah?
Yeah, that sounds great. Thank you so much for having me.
Amazing. Well, let's get started with some rapid fire questions just so our listeners can get to know you a little bit better. Could you give us a one-liner to describe yourself?
Absolutely. So Sarah Vick is a 36-year-old woman, academic hospitalist, wife and mother of two funny, passionate children who love to read, who I love to read and spend time outside.
I love that. Is there a book that y'all are reading right now or maybe a book that you personally have recently enjoyed?
Absolutely. So as I said, I love to read books. And so the one I actually just finished is called Twice as Hard. And it's the stories of Black women who fought to become physicians from the Civil War to the 21st century by Jasmine Brown. It's a fabulous read.
Very cool. I haven't heard of that one. I'll have to check it out. Do you have a favorite failure that you'd feel comfortable sharing? Then something that you've learned from that?
Absolutely. So I played JV soccer when I was in high school, and I had always been someone who was accustomed to being very good at most things, but I found myself in a position of being surrounded by women who were significantly better at soccer than I was. And so I played probably about 5 minutes the whole season. I was definitely on the bench. But I think some of the things I learned from this was, A, it's not always my role to be the one who's in charge and on the field. You know, in this position, I was the kind of cheerleader and the one who was always there to help and support my team members, but also that position of I showed up every day and I worked hard and I went from my improvement of my skills each and every day to be just a little bit better. And I think that that's something I certainly have carried into my medical career because I'm always surrounded by people who are, exceptional. And so it's nice to be able to work on myself a little bit every day.
Totally. It's kind of like the finding the growth edge for yourself and recognizing that, we're all improving and we're all among people who are equally trying to improve, we hope,
Absolutely.
Day by day. Well, Sarah, we had the pleasure of seeing your workshop at the Alliance's AIM Week 24 this spring, and the topic was clinical reasoning, which, is our episode as well. Was there something that you have learned since giving that workshop or kind of in thinking about this topic that you wanted to share?
I think that thing that I have learned since giving this workshop is that we are just all in the same boat. I think we all realize just how important this topic is, but also just how incredibly hard it is. And we're all doing things a little differently. And so it's nice to be able to have these collaborative discussions about best practices and how we can all work together to improve our learners. So that was really my takeaway. Important, but hard.
I love that. And it's hard because there's so many things that we're trying to think about as educators. And I feel like every week we do these shows and afterward, I'm like so pumped. I'm like, I'm going to totally take that back to clinic. And then I get to clinic and I'm like, but there's 1500 other things. So, but clinical reasoning is a very important one. So I'm glad we're spending the time today. Before we dive deep in that, Ira, I know you have a pick of the week you'd like to share.
I do, Molly. Thanks for welcoming this opportunity to share. So I was on service at the hospital on consults for addiction medicine, and we were, you know, furiously writing our notes. And sometimes it's really nice to have music in the background when we're writing. And so somebody put on this band slash, we'll say, performer, Waxahachie. I don't know if y'all have heard of them or I guess heard. It's like an indie band, but I would put it in the, like, it has bluegrass country kind of indie feels. It's led by Katie Crutchfield, but I guess it has other accompaniment as well. And she named it after, I think, a creek in Alabama, her home state. And her music is just really fun. Like, I felt like I was like writing my notes and I was like, oh my God, am I like enjoying writing my notes? And I don't think it was the notes. I think it was the background music, but maybe I can play like less than 5 seconds of it just so that y'all can hear it for a second. We'll see. Is that allowed, Molly? Can I do that?
I think if it's quick, I don't know what the official rules are, but yeah,
okay. let's take a listen. We're going to less than 5 seconds.
A listening party.
Yeah, listening party. Is that 5 seconds? I got really nervous. That was like, is that more or less than 5 seconds?
2 seconds, but we got like a little taste.
Yeah, basically it's like, imagine indie kind of, I don't know, just light. You feel like light and bright and happy. So if anybody wants to check it out, Waxahachie, and I think she's touring or they're touring throughout the kind of spring and summer of 2024. So
I love it. Maybe we can jump into our case for this week here. We have our case from Cashlec Memorial just to get us grounded. We have Tony. He's an early trainee with whom you've only worked with once in clinic. He has struggled with the time he needed to see 3 patients in a half day of clinic. And other preceptors have noted to you as the educational site director that there are some concerns about his presentations and plans. You're looking forward to working with him today to see how things are going. Tony starts by presenting the first patient to you saying, "This is a 52-year-old man with continuous burning chest pain for 2 weeks. I think he may need to urgently be ruled out for acute coronary syndrome." Your interest is piqued, and you ask him to finish his full presentation as you'd like to hear more about why he thinks about acute coronary syndrome. So, Sarah, we're excited to be talking with you to do a little bit more of a deep dive after your Alliance for Academic Internal Medicine Week workshop on this topic. Before hearing about your initial reactions to Tony's particular presentation and case, we'd love to get some definitions settled just so we're all on the same page. How do you define clinical reasoning, and are there particular domains that are involved that we need to know about?
Oh, that's such a great question and such a great case. So I always refer to Dr. Bowen's definition from her New England Journal of Medicine article. And when she talks about the process of collecting clinical data, but also incorporating your knowledge and experience and the context. And she always highlights those certain areas of clinical reasoning generally incorporates patient history and exam to elaborate this accurate problem representation and to generate a hypothesis, and then think about those illness scripts or schemas that lead to a diagnosis or a differential. So at its core, it's about thinking through that patient presentation and all of those different elements to get to that differential and diagnosis.
Thank you, Sarah. That was super helpful. And we had a kind of great episode on this on the Curbsiders main feed, which we'll link to that episode too, just to make sure we're on the same page. And thank you for those very clear definitions. When we think about specifically kind of Tony's case, maybe you can share your initial reactions, and we can also get into kind of how clinical reasoning is thought about in HPE or health professions education kind of broadly.
Absolutely. I found it so interesting, you know, hearing Tony's presentation where he certainly highlights certain pieces. You know, I hear those semantic qualifiers of continuous and burning and 2 weeks, and then going straight to, don't get me wrong, I can't miss diagnosis, but probably not the thing I would consider most likely. So that's my initial sort of like, okay, like tell me more, Tony. And I think when we think about this in kind of health professions education, we always really want to look for what the learner is showing us. And what I mean by that is Tony is showing me that clearly he spent some time and got some good history related to chest pain, but clearly wasn't able to sort of put those pieces together in a way that was meaningful. So what I'm listening for oftentimes in these moments are like, can they A, generate a hypothesis based on this chief complaint? And then are they considering like anchoring bias, or they recently had a patient who had ACS and they don't want to forget about it and that recall bias, or maybe even just like ability to like prioritize a differential, which I'm not sure he had much of a differential here. But I worry about him being able to like synthesize that information and pull those illness scripts reasonably to be able to like do anything else with that. So I think for me, it's always just about like, where are the learners showing us how they're thinking? And in this case, I worry that he's not putting those pieces together in a way that makes sense.
And do you have a framework for us as educators, or kind of a hierarchy that we can pin down or a little bit more simply, so that we can try to start to figure out exactly where a learner might have trouble and then be able to think about where to remediate?
Absolutely. And I think anywhere you look in the medical literature, whether it's articles or books or MedEd Portal or any of the fabulous resources we have available, there are many different ways to approach this. My colleague Megan Woolock and I really thought about this in sort of like a pyramid structure, where the skills at the bottom are the most essential to be able to accomplish before you move up to sort of higher order clinical reasoning, if you will. So for us, that base of the pyramid was really this hypothesis generation. And the behaviors you're really looking for are, what history are they gathering? What data are they reporting to you? Do they know those semantic qualifiers, as Tony may or may not have alluded to? And then once you get past that, you're really assessing for the next level up is premature closure. And I would kind of caveat that as any of those kind of metacognitive processes where we're thinking about recall bias and ways to make sure that we're checking our understanding before we just charge forward and ignore all the other data. And once we've done those things as kind of the two base pieces of our pyramid, that next step up is prioritization. And when we're looking for prioritization, people who struggle with this have no real clear understanding of kind of the minor points of those chief concern. They don't have knowledge of the discriminating features of like, oh, the difference between this diagnosis and this diagnosis is the absence of blank feature, for example. And I think once we're able to have a learner understand how to prioritize and know those discriminating features, the next level up would be that synthesis. So they've gathered the data, they've analyzed the process, they've made a prioritized differential. Then they really have to put those pieces together in a way that makes sense. So again, recognizing the illness script for ACS, for COPD exacerbation, and being able to highlight those features. And then the last piece, kind of that like capstone on the pyramid, if you will, is management plans. So are the management plans kind of vague and inappropriate? Maybe the patient is not interested in any sort of, you know, intensive diagnostic process, and your learner is recommending like an open brain biopsy, and you're like, whoa, let's talk about patient-centered and maybe evidence-based care. So I think for me and for Dr. Woolock, those kind of pyramids of like hypothesis generation, premature closure, prioritization, synthesis, and then that kind of capstone of management is how we would approach a kind of clinical reasoning dilemma.
I love that, Sarah. And we'll link to images of that pyramid that you shared from the workshop too in the show notes, so people can visualize it as you say it, because that was a beautiful kind of breakdown of each section. One thing that I recall you saying in the workshop is that just because somebody might have the right reasoning, that may not lead them to the right diagnosis. And I wonder how that like really catchy phrase kind of fits into that pyramid framework that you just took us through.
I think for me, it's just that clinical reasoning is fraught with challenges, which is why this is such an important topic. And so I think for me, even if a learner is able to pick out those key features, doesn't mean that they can apply it to that particular patient or draw that particular illness script. Or even, hey, we just saw this patient with this similar diagnosis. Are they able to apply those same reasoning and those same features to a new patient and a new problem? So for me, it fits into this schema because I like to think that clinical reasoning is the process of showing our cognitive work. And when we show our cognitive work, we as the coaches are better able to not only see where they are and maybe where that lesion or that deficit is, but also being able to connect them to the appropriate management plan and help them improve their clinical reasoning. So yes, it's great when they understand the process, but it doesn't always mean that they make the right conclusion.
And just to clarify a little bit, so I think the hypothesis generation makes pretty intuitive sense to me, and I appreciate the need to avoid premature closure. How do you see the difference between the prioritization and the synthesis? I mean, I feel like illness scripts kind of need to fit into the prioritization as well.
Oh, that's such a great question. And I think for me, prioritization includes those discriminating features, because I feel like when I'm pulling illness scripts in that synthesis piece, it's like, okay, I have these five things that I think are super common with chest pain. But unless I know what those discriminating features are and have asked them in an appropriate way, there's no way I'm going to be able to pick the correct illness script to then be able to say like, oh, yes, of course, this is what I think the most likely diagnosis is. And so I think that for me, the difference between prioritization and synthesis is just the discriminating feature versus putting all the elements together. Does that make sense?
That does. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. So it's kind of continuing to generate the hypothesis as you go and building pieces off the history to then be able to build the right problem representation into the right illness script. Perfect. So not to complicate things further, but is there a place in this hierarchy, in this framework or pyramid that you presented, that system one versus system two thinking comes in? And can you define those for us?
Oh, absolutely. I feel like system one and system two is just inherent to how we as doctors think. And so I definitely think that this applies to the pyramid structure. So system one is our kind of like intuitive, quick, I like to think of it as kind of like Pictionary, where you recognize the pattern and you make the diagnosis or you guess the picture. Whereas system two is that much more methodical, slow process, kind of like Clue, where it's like Colonel Mustard in the conservatory with the lead pipe, right? But I think both are super necessary. I think for me, in this particular framework, you know, Megan and I were really thinking about like the foundation of clinical reasoning is these two separate processes, but you certainly see them. System one in the premature closure, metacognitive biases, because we all know that kind of quick thinking is much more prone to those cognitive errors. But I think system two especially is that process of like, okay, I didn't necessarily recognize that initially. So how am I going to put those pieces together in that synthesis category of like, okay, am I going to lump or am I going to split these features? Is this something where I need to be concerned that this is not present? And how am I going to pull the right illness script to be very slow and methodical about that process? So for me, I'm listening for both, but I definitely think that it's inherent in any type of clinical reasoning that we do.
And that's super helpful, Sarah, because I do think that sometimes we, you know, within clinical reasoning education, also learners and, you know, teachers hear about these two types of thinking. And I think clarifying kind of where along the pyramid, we might see this is helpful to name, I think, for the learners and for teachers in general. So if we zoom in to parts of the pyramid, and let's say we're going to start low and go slow, as if we're taking care of apparently a patient in the geriatric world, let's think about hypothesis generation. Maybe you could share some challenges that learners and honestly all of us as clinicians may face with this particular clinical reasoning step.
I think truthfully, for hypothesis generation to be effective, we actually have to cognitively engage with it. And I think that's what potentially makes it really hard, is that we all make so many decisions and we have such busy days that being able to really sit down and think like, based on this patient's presentation and their demographics and what am I thinking of? What's most likely? What's common where I practice? And so it's not only the cognitive engagement piece, but I think also the other piece is that so much of how we learned medicine is through checklists, right? So when I have someone with chest pain, these are the 15 things I have to ask them without any real understanding of, okay, this is a discriminating feature. And this is something that's super common to help parse out between this diagnosis and that, Or, okay, like I've asked like location, duration, blah, 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 but I don't know what then to do with that to move forward. So I think for me, it's a combination of being present and actually thinking in those moments, but also making sure that we aren't just relying on checklists.
And how do you, as an educator, help to identify that the hypothesis generation is a problem? How do you see that in a learner?
One of the ways you see that is you have someone that like goes in and can list like, I have someone with chest pain. It is substernal, radiating to the left, da 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 da. And then you're like, okay, kind of like Tony, like, what do you think it is? And they have no ability to understand that there were certain things that they should have asked or should have explored more. So say, for example, it's someone with chest pain that recently had a viral illness. And oh, by the way, they have diffuse ST elevations and all of these other things. And so understanding that like, oh, I probably should explore more that they had a viral illness 2 weeks ago, or they just started a new chest routine at the gym. And that's why they have tenderness to palpation on their chest wall. And so I think for me, that ability to hear them think through and ask those supporting questions based on what they think is most likely in that patient is super helpful to be able to identify that.
Do you think that's usually a medical knowledge issue that maybe the learner doesn't have the knowledge to be able to build that out? Or is it primarily a clinical reasoning problem often that they just haven't been able to link the pieces together?
I'd say we talked about this in the workshop era. It's so funny that we're talking about this now. I think medical knowledge is absolutely kind of the floor of many of these things, but I would submit to you that like medical knowledge, go read more, whatever, is probably more a symptom of knowledge organization, especially when you're talking about higher order clinical reasoning about illness scripts and how they organize the fact that pericarditis should have this particular symptomatology. And I think sometimes it's on us as the teachers to really help our learners organize that information in addition to like, yes, of course, they need to be able to like look through things, read an EKG, that sort of thing. But what we have the benefit of is the experience and the understanding of how likely something is and how important one feature is compared to another. And by listening to that and helping them organize that information, that's where I think the bigger clinical reasoning kind of opportunity is.
I think that opportunity is a nice segue, Sarah, for us to think about like, what is the opportunity for the educator or teacher here? Meaning if there is a deficit in, let's say, the domain of hypothesis generation, or, you know, feel free if you want to jump into premature closure, but how would you suggest that educators kind of address that, or techniques that we can help both maybe identify and address?
So I think it's one of those things where it's always helpful, as the vignette sort of alluded to like let them explain what they're thinking, like show their work in many ways. But I think specifically for hypothesis generation, direct observation is one of the most useful ways to see how is that learner asking questions. Is it clear that they're just going through a checklist, or they're just kind of have that really disorganized, like, oh, I'm going to ask about this, and then I'm going to go over here, and then I'm going to listen to the heart, and then I'm going to do something else. And I think in those moments of directly observing them, we can really see how they're putting those pieces together. Now, I realize direct observation takes time, but it can be an incredibly rich source of data when you're talking about history taking and hypothesis generation, because you are in the room when those things are being done. And then I think the other thing too is that really asking Tony, especially, to say like, okay, like, tell me more. How did you come to this? And having him have that opportunity to explain the why and the connections he's making can also get you to hypothesis generation. I would say the last piece is just documentation review, because I know many of us, you know, are busy hospitalists or busy working in a clinic. And so we may not have time to be able to like sit in a room and directly observe, but having someone review a note with you and see like, how did you explain why you decided it was this diagnosis versus another? What history and exam did they feel was pertinent to document and how they put those pieces together? So I think that those are the most important things, is direct observation, having them really explain the why, and then reviewing their documentation for those hypothesis generation cues.
Those sound like some great tips to get some real in the moment information to be able to give more targeted feedback. If we do feel like Tony's problem was the hypothesis generation when he's explained his thinking, or we've watched him in the room with the patient, or we've looked over his notes, what would be an example of a remediation prescription that an educator could give a learner like Tony to help improve his hypothesis generation?
So I definitely think when you're thinking about a remediation plan, you're trying to think of like, okay, hypothesis generation is clearly what's going on. Role play, as much as that pains me to say, is an incredibly effective way to get at that in a sort of lower stakes environment. I realize role play is not everybody's jam, but if I'm playing a patient and I know what the diagnosis is ultimately going to be, listening to the learner take a history and then tell me, I would do a cardiac exam listening for a heart murmur, and lower extremity edema would be an incredibly important discriminating feature for me. That process of discussing how they would gather that data and then what they would do with it is a really rich way to help that process. And then, of course, I would probably prescribe some type of direct observation or documentation review, depending on what type of clinical scenario we're talking about, because I think that those real life encounters really help learners invest in the process because it's applicable to the human beings that they are taking care of rather than this other random, you know, non-real human that I am making up out of my head, if that makes sense.
I love that because it feels like, Sarah, the direct observation and documentation review are part of the like DX and the TX. Like we're coming, you know, into a place of data gathering, and then we're also using the same thing for the, you know, treatment or RX component. And I almost feel like it's can be helpful to the learners to say like, this is going to be something that we continue doing. You know, it's a process where we will return to this to see how things are going.
Yes, exactly.
And is it similar to how you would approach, let's say, somebody who had a deficit around premature closure? Or are there kind of other more nuanced things that you might consider?
I would say that I think the key to premature closure is A, helping the learner recognize the importance of examining their thinking and making sure they're not missing anything. But really in those situations, I think it's more helpful to have them think through, okay, what is your expected trajectory if this patient really does have heart failure and we diuresed them? When would you expect this to get better? When would you expect them to come off of oxygen? And I think another way to think about that is, especially if you're like a day or two into a hospital stay, for example, and it is not following your expected trajectory, encouraging the team to take what I like to call is like a diagnostic timeout. So what else could this be? Are there other features that we are not incorporating or maybe ignoring that didn't fit with our diagnosis of heart failure, for example? And what else could this be? And sort of revisiting that process. But truthfully, for me, the most important way to help a learner understand the pitfalls of premature closure is really just to model that behavior. When we are a couple days into a hospital stay, being like, I didn't think about this either. Let's talk through how we can course correct or what I would have expected for this heart failure patient that we're diuresing.
Well, I think that that's huge, Sarah, because I think that like role modeling this piece is key, both to show that, like, you know, we are, again, growth focused and we're all just trying to get better, but also to show learners that like everybody has moments of premature closure and this is something that we're, you know, trying to identify and move on. And maybe, you know, we could think about Tony for a second. If you think about the case that we presented, do you feel like, you know, hypothesis generation and premature closure or something else potentially were the issue here? And, you know, is there anything that you would specifically do for him in that moment?
I would be very curious to have like been a fly on the wall in that room and kind of gotten to where he was in that process. But I do think I had talked a little bit about this in the workshop, but there's this REACT framework where, similar to that, as you had alluded to before, Era, where we're talking about like diagnosis and treatment, it's a framework to be able to use direct observation to diagnose and help create a remediation plan. So REACT stands for Rapid Evaluation Assessment of Clinical Reasoning Tool. And it's got five domains. So for Tony, I would really focus on that first two domains of collecting and interpreting. Because for me, I want to know what data he gathered, but also how he generated his differential diagnosis based on that data. And the nice thing about the REACT framework is that it has specific anchors that I can then sit in the room and be like, okay, you had a non-focus history and exam, and you were missing likely and can't miss diagnoses. And so being able to talk through, not only do I think that that was your issue with hypothesis generation, but then I can create a remediation plan with Tony to help him ask more pointed questions related to chest pain in this particular situation.
Amazing. Well, you're giving us lots of frameworks here, which is super helpful. I think we're in a good place with Tony's hypothesis generation, and we've helped him work through his premature closure. And now we're ready to move up the pyramid a little bit. And we realized that Tony didn't include a formal problem representation in his presentation to you about this patient. And so what are the key steps in creating problem representations, and where can issues or breakdowns in this aspect of clinical reasoning come up?
I think one of the key features, or one of the key ways to get at this, is A, they actually have to do it. It's amazing to me how many learners I work with where it's like, this is a 65-year-old man with toe pain and diabetes and hypertension and GERD and da-da-da-da-da. And this like, not a problem representation, but just like a rehash of the HPI. And so number one, it's just being able to recognize that your problem representation really needs to be those most salient points related to the differential that you're about to generate. And so that involves, though, many of the things that we've been talking about. Do they recognize things like semantic qualifiers, things like acute versus chronic, and how that changes your differential diagnosis, unilateral versus bilateral joint pain and swelling, and how that changes your differential diagnosis? But really, when you're having someone who's really struggling in this domain, especially, asking them why they chose the features, and then having them play this game, it's called by a qualifier, where they basically get to pick two qualifiers that they think are the most essential to creating this differential. So acute, unilateral, for example. And then talking through the why they picked those and helping them understand those discriminating features. Other things that preceptors can do, we can use formats like the one-minute preceptor or SNAPs to be able to help the learners reflect on that thinking. But one of the other ones I really like is an IDEAS. It's another mnemonic. This is particularly for documentation, though, with the problem representation. And what you're looking for is like, okay, what is your, the I is the interpretive summary. And there are specific anchors of what makes a good versus excellent interpretive summary. And it has things like key features, pertinent negatives, those semantic qualifiers. And so being able to sit down and look at how did they include and why did they include what they did can really help you craft problem representations with your learners.
And maybe I missed it, Sarah. What's the rest of the IDEAS? Did I miss the D and the E and the A and the S? Or am I just maybe having a hallucination? It's also very possible.
No hallucination. I only focus on the idea because we were talking about problem representation, but the rest of the idea framework. So I is interpretive summary. D is the differential with commitment on the most likely, which is sort of the key part of the D. The A is explaining the reasoning in choosing the most likely. And then A is alternative diagnosis with explanations in the reasoning. And again, this is related to documentation. And so the point here of using the IDEA framework is, are they able to show their work of how do they decide what's most likely and what are their alternatives and why?
Yeah, I love that each of the IDEAS piece has like an extra, like it's interpretive summary, but with key features, like differential, but you got to commit, and then like explain your reasoning and give an alternate diagnosis, but with an explanation. I feel like each of those qualifiers, because we're talking about by and qualifier, I feel like really allows people to truly show their work and show kind of the cognitive decisions that they made. And I guess, are there, you know, steps that we've maybe haven't highlighted yet, when once a learner has kind of been able to generate the hypothesis, they've avoided premature closure, and now they're working on kind of that problem representation. Is there something else that they need to really be able to prioritize and kind of synthesize in order to really settle in on a prioritized differential?
I definitely think for me, it's listening for some of those discriminating features like we had talked about in that like prioritization and synthesis piece, because it's the question of you have the learner who has like fever as problem number one with a differential, right upper quadrant pain as problem number two with a differential, and then jaundice as problem number three with a differential. And the question for that learner is clearly they're splitting instead of lumping because they don't recognize the syndrome of fever, right upper quadrant pain, jaundice that has in and of itself their own differential diagnosis. And so some of that prioritization piece is being able to understand that some of those things go together and you should lump that. And then when we talk about synthesis, I think it's a question of comparing illness scripts. I really love being able to create like a chart of, all right, based on this presentation, your most likely diagnoses are A, B, C, D, E across the top. And then on the side, having what are the demographics you would expect in this particular case? What are the key features? What are the exam findings? What are the laboratory findings you would expect? And filling in the grid for all of the diagnoses. And then I'll hand them a case that's clearly one of them. And their job is then, based on their sheet, to highlight the features that are present that can help them make that diagnosis. And I think this hammers home for me with learners that illness scripts are about comparing and contrasting what's present and what's not. And it really makes it a tangible thing when they have to write it down.
I love that. Sounds very practical and doable in the moment. When you're kind of listening to a presentation or witnessing an interaction in the room with a patient or reviewing documentation, what are some clues that the learner might really be struggling with their illness scripts primarily?
I think when you're listening to those things, it is, are they able to recognize those features that help you decide if it's A or B? And I think, too, it's even some of the outside of the room that helps me with the illness scripts, because it's like, okay, you thought it was diagnosis A or diagnosis B or diagnosis C. I now have a CT scan that I, as the doctor, know makes diagnosis A essentially 0% likely, but makes diagnosis B significantly more likely. And so watching them work through that kind of working diagnosis of, okay, now that I have new information, how does that change my differential? And that, to me, highlights, do they understand how this piece of information is going to impact the illness script that they know? So I think it's always that working diagnosis that helps me more with illness scripts rather than the physical things that I'm going to see in the room. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you.
I guess, Sarah, I wonder, did we cover what needs to be covered for learners who have, you know, deficits in domains up until kind of that management plan area that you wanted to highlight?
I definitely think so. And I think the other thing that I always feel like is sometimes we're sitting there and trying to parse the like, oh, if is it this or is it this? But for me, if you're ever in between two, the most important thing is to start at the lowest. And until they have accomplished with reasonable consistency the ability to generate a hypothesis, it's really hard to move up the pyramid until you have those foundational skills very, very down pat.
That's super helpful. And what I'm hearing you say also, if the illness script is kind of the issue in terms of remediating that area, it's really, I love that like whiteboard example of kind of like, let's list out certain features and kind of why that this would fit under one as opposed to the other. Is that right?
That is exactly right.
So if we're like one step past that and you're encountering someone who maybe has difficulties around kind of a nuanced plan or a plan that has contingencies, how do you remediate a situation where that's kind of the issue coming up?
Absolutely. I think that this is often that senior resident who like, yeah, you nailed the diagnosis that you think is most likely. But it's like, so what if it's not? And so I think for me, I always like to do kind of three things. One is really encouraging the learner to consider alternatives. And what I mean by that is, all right, we really think that all these features fit this diagnosis. Is there anything else that could potentially meet all of these same features that we're not thinking about? what about this possible, you know, finding on the chest x-ray? We're not incorporating that into our differential. Tell me more about that. And really encouraging them to reconsider all the data in a meaningful way. I think the next thing I like to do is reflect on, as I had said before, that expected course. If I have someone who's hypoxic from volume overload, how long do I expect that to continue? If we've been diuresing this person and they're net negative 15 liters and they're still on a bunch of oxygen, is my diagnosis correct? How do I encourage my learner to really think about, okay, I expect this to happen by this time. And if it's not, what else am I thinking is going on? And then I think the last step is really making it concrete and really having them delineate the steps. So if X happens, if the patient fevers tonight after we stopped antibiotics, then what? How will this CT scan that you want to order change your plan? What would make you reconsider your working diagnosis? And being very transparent and granular about that and making them commit, I feel like is not only helpful to make sure that we're not missing anything, but also helps them think about management plans more than like one step ahead of like diuresis, yes, but like what's down the line? Show their work and talk about that.
Excellent. Well, I think these are super practical steps for in the moment on wards or in the clinic. And I know most of our focus today is around remediation. Do you also teach these more explicitly, like at the beginning of a rotation or to the medical students to try to like learn these in a proactive way rather than a reactive approach?
It's actually really funny you say that. So one of the other hats that I wear for the last 6 years is I teach a course for the third year medical students where one of the steps is like, all right, this is how you generate an illness script. This is what like a cognitive bias is and how you can really think about it when it's present and forcing them really to think about contingency plans. And I think in those situations, it's really helpful to have very granular cases. And again, have them write out their illness script in a grid or talk through what those next steps are. Because truthfully, they're in that process anyway. It's really nice to be able to like call out those things. But yes, I would love more of that. I think we really need to be very explicit in teaching these skills to our learners as they go through, or else they're never going to be able to just be like, I wonder if I'm having recall bias in this situation. It's really important to like call that out.
And just to piggyback off of Molly's question, because I love that. Sarah, do you ever share kind of like, this is the REACT framework, or this is the clinical reasoning tool that you might see on wards or in clinic, and like, you know, for medical students or honestly any health professions learner to see kind of this is potentially an assessment strategy that you might encounter, and this is why we're kind of teaching, you know, these particular domains too.
Absolutely. We are actually in the process of creating a faculty development program in Kentucky with those exact things, because I think many of our faculty, and I'm sure this is true universally, it's like this seems like big time asks. And in some ways it is, but also in the moment, being able to use the REACT framework for one direct observation for one student is actually not as time intensive as you would think. And so our hope is to be able to give these very accessible frameworks to our faculty to be able to improve not only their diagnosis, but also their treatment plans and their ability to provide clear, measurable outcomes to improve those skills. So not yet, but hopefully soon.
And we've done a few other topics around remediation, not specifically clinical reasoning remediation. But I'm just wondering about your thoughts on like if you are the site director in the continuity clinic, or you're the hospitalist who's rounding with the learner and you're seeing these concerns, when do you recommend that faculty educators kind of escalate that up to the residence advisor or the program director? You know, what kind of, where do we get other people involved, and or do you pass that information on to the next hospitalist coming on?
I think that is such a fascinating question. And I love talking about this. So I think I'll answer the last question first and then I'll come back. So I love a good learner checkout. So like when I am handing off my team at the end of my 2 weeks, I'm always like, all right, I've been working with student X. And the thing I have given them feedback on is they are struggling to generate a hypothesis. And here's the things that I've been working on with them. I would love if you would continue doing this with the next step of being blank. Because I think sometimes when we come in with these learners, you obviously don't want to bias anybody coming in, but I also think it serves as a, it seems like whiplash in many ways when it, you're getting one set of feedback from one attending and a different set of feedback from another. And so I think effective learner checkout is grounded in a lot of these skills. But also, I think when you're thinking through how you have the time and how you do these things, if you're in clinic or on wards or any of this, I think escalation for me depends on one, are they receptive to the feedback? So like I've been working with a learner for a few days. I've given them particulars of feedback. They aren't listening. They're not taking it. They're showing no progress. Then I'm much more likely to escalate that concern. I think another way that I would escalate it is if it's multi-domain, meaning I'm concerned about patient safety and not just this learner's ability to, you know, continue along in their medical education. They are making decisions that are potentially or could potentially result in harm or are causing situations where the other learners on the team feel unsafe. And I think those are the situations I always escalate. But most of the other stuff, I feel like, especially when you have learners that are early on in their training, we have so much time with them and so much ability to give them feedback and help grow these skills. And if you can get on board with them early, you really have so much opportunity to build and grow without needing to escalate. But I think not receptive to feedback and patient safety concerns are my two, like, 100% escalate.
That's super helpful, Sarah. I guess I wonder if we were to return back to Tony, because we can't forget Tony in these situations. If there were, I mean, maybe this is potentially Tony's case, but maybe some of the faculty preceptors are concerned that Tony is kind of struggling in all the domains of the pyramid that you presented. And, you know, it can be kind of overwhelming sometimes, especially if you're that preceptor or that hospitalist who's working with the learner like Tony. Where do you suggest that kind of educators approach the situation? Do you have another framework and maybe another idea or something else that you would recommend?
I think, as always, I had said before, start at the bottom. But if someone like Tony is having multi-domain concerns, I definitely think escalating that and getting a more consistent remediation plan. And what I mean by that is calling in reinforcements. This is definitely not something that you as the clinic preceptor or you as the hospitalist on for 2 weeks is going to be able to help. Because when you have someone who has multiple issues, it's going to take many touches and many meetings and lots of discussion. And honestly, in Kentucky, we have clinical reasoning coaches that we have them meet with a faculty member who's a clinical reasoning coach. They meet with their program director or associate program director, in addition to providing them words to be able to say, I am working on this particular skill. I would like you, attending on wards, clinic, et cetera, to provide me feedback on this domain. And ideally, that starts again at the bottom and then kind of works their way up. But I think if a learner like Tony has this many domains, like, he needs all hands on deck. No magic, just time.
Totally agree. We love you, Tony, and we are ready to give you all hands on deck. One thing we didn't talk about that sometimes comes up in management reasoning too is kind of like the equity check, or kind of thinking about how did I think about where kind of equity would come into play here. And I wonder, are there areas of the pyramid where you find yourself noticing that for a learner? Like, did we consider, is it in the management plan potentially where we're thinking about how did I choose this antibiotic, or what do I think is the expected course for this patient based on particular kind of demographics or otherwise? And, you know, how do you, I don't want to say like remediate that, but how do you like draw attention to that if that's an issue?
Absolutely. I think being able to consider particular, you know, social determinants of health or certain, you know, patient demographic considerations is absolutely part of that discussion. But I agree, it does fall in that management piece of when you're talking through the particulars of this, you know, patient situation, maybe they're unhoused and you can't prescribe IV antibiotics. Like, how do you talk through the nuances of this versus that? And I think, honestly, it's on us in many ways to have that conversation in a very open way. And for me, I like to acknowledge sometimes, like, this is really hard and it feels bad sometimes. But the more we talk through it and highlight what we can do as physicians, I think it really empowers our learners to continue to work hard and learn those particular nuances. Does that answer your question?
I like that answer. And it also made me reflect, and I was kind of thinking before about the flip side of that, like our equity pause when we look at our learners and kind of thinking more broadly. I know this was a very focused on the problem is clinical reasoning, but sometimes I think it can look like clinical reasoning and really the learner has a mental health problem that's undertreated, or the learner is, you know, has a heavy cognitive load from extraneous things. And just sort of taking that personal, as an educator, equity pause to say, like, what else might be affecting this learner?
I think it's especially helpful, like, thinking through the D's, as we always talk about, depression, drugs, et cetera. But, like, I think for me, it's helpful when I know the learner and it's a clear delta of, like, you weren't always on this trajectory. I definitely think that, but you're totally right, Molly. I think we should all sort of pause, especially as we're getting ready to welcome new learners that we don't necessarily know, to always think about, huh, is there something else going on the kind of underbelly of all of this? Love it.
Any other last questions, Ira?
I know you think that there's going to be some, Molly. Don't worry. I usually save it right before anything you want to plug. That's like where
that's a good spot just to get it.
Yeah.
Well, Sarah, these have been such helpful frameworks and I think some really actionable things to take back to clinic for me and back to the wards for people who work there. I think you kind of gave us take home points, but do you have any others?
I think my only other thing is that, like, this is something that is certainly effort, but I have always felt like every time I engage in this process of helping a learner improve their clinical reasoning skills, the success is so worth it, and why I think we all stay in medical education. So, like, whatever those frameworks are, you know, helping those learners improve is definitely value added.
I think sometimes people just need to know that you care, you know, and that this is, like, actually a way to show that. Is there anything, Sarah, that you want to plug? Maybe something you're working on? I know I heard you mention the faculty development workshop, but anything else that you want to mention?
I think the one thing I want to plug is my, like, co-presenter, Megan Woolock. She is lovely in every way, and I so appreciate all her help. But I think the other thing that I really wanted to plug is just being able to have a cohort of faculty who deeply care about your learners and want to help them remediate clinical reasoning can help this feel less daunting. We have clinical remediation coaches that Dr. Kristen Fletcher has helped us create, and providing them resources and dedicated faculty development has helped us in Kentucky really make this less of a lift when you have multiple learners that are on remediation plans. So, like, ask for help. There's so many resources out there, MedEd portal, so many books, you know, remediation and medical education, but get resources. It's super worth it.
I'm ready for your faculty development workshop to be posted on MedEd portal, Sarah. So let's go.
Fingers crossed.
Thank you. This has been amazing.
Thank you so much for sharing your time and expertise. And we're very excited to share this with our listeners.
Well, thank you both for having me. This was lovely. Not nearly as stressful as I thought it was going to be. This is great.
Okay.
Remember, we're stress-free. Weird, awkward, flexible, and stress-free. That's the, got it. That's the new motto.
Well, that was such a great episode with Dr. Sarah Vick. I feel like I've, you know, really kind of broken down those steps in clinical reasoning that can help me diagnose where some of my learners may be struggling in this domain. And I just really love kind of the breaking down the pyramid of starting at the base, making sure the learners have a good, strong foundation with hypothesis generation and are avoiding premature closure, and then kind of moving up the pyramid once those foundational skills are established.
I'm totally with you, Molly. I think just breaking it down is helpful for me every single time. Like, I need that exercise. And I think maybe it might be helpful for me to role model that, like, these are the domains that we're looking for. And, you know, when I'm precepting or kind of working with a learner on wards, just making sure that I've clearly laid out, like, this is where in the clinical reasoning world I am kind of using for assessment. Like, these are the pyramid areas, and also just reminding learners that like the direct observation and the documentation review, like this is both diagnostic and therapeutic, meaning like I want to see the growth and I want to also figure out where we're at, where are our growth edges and name those for learners.
Love the growth edges.
You know me, so edgy.
This has been another episode of our Curbsiders series, The Curbsiders Teach. Get your show notes at thecurbsiders.com/teach. A special thanks to the Alliance for Academic Internal Medicine for making this season possible. And thanks to Dr. Matt Lotto and Dr. Paul Williams for their support in this project. Thanks to the team at PodPace for editing and production support. Until next time, I've been Dr. Molly Hoybein.
And we're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge. But to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts or contact us at thecurbsidersteach@gmail.com. A reminder that this and most episodes are available for CME credit for all healthcare professionals at thecurbsiders.vcuhealth.org. All you have to do is create an account. And I'm Dr. Ira Krasnovskaya. Thank you so much for joining us today and letting us bring you a little nugget of medical edutainment.